others. Anyway, thank you, Christian. Thank you, Zerim. Thank you, Juhantti, for the kind invitation, first of all, and indeed for the fantastic introduction. I think this is a really great setup, this HIMOS thing, and I just wish that you will be doing this more than two times a year that you mentioned. So maybe four times a year, since this is the second this year already, right? Or did I get it wrong? Anyway, I'm so glad because most of us share this interest in history, and some of you are really trained historians. I'm one of those who is more like a slow learner or a fake historian, sort of picking up this thing only a little bit later. But I want to share an anecdote. First of all, Jyväskylä is close to my heart. I'm actually an adjunct professor there, and maybe not everyone knows this, but I also have this background that my great grandfather and great grandmother were studying there at the turn of the century, and actually my great grandfather became a historian. So I want to claim some of this to myself as well. Anyway, I'm extremely pleased for this opportunity because of two reasons. One is that this is a great chance to talk about the issue of how can we basically learn from studying organizations that are not the usual ones that we typically focus on and talk about in business schools in particular, and then publish in our leading journals. And this to me connects with the historical methods. In part, this is something that most of us are struggling with, and of course, seeing many old friends and young friends here, I know that we have many great examples of people who have been pulling this off so many times, and people indeed to follow. But what I'll be trying to do here is to still say a few words about how this works in my mind, combining both my failures and successes as an author, but also experiences as an editor and reviewer. And let's see if it works. So that's like the first part that gives us some kind of a framing to then zoom in on our paper on the Sicilian Mafia. And that's the second reason for really feeling happy, because I get to advertise this paper, which is in a way fresh from the oven, because it was just very recently, early this year, published in AMJ. Of course, it's been around for quite some time and is based on a long-term interest in the Sicilian Mafia, as most of our projects tend to be, that is long-lasting and taking some time. So that's basically the plan for my presentation. And I don't mind if there are questions along the way, but anyway, I'll try to keep this relatively short, even if there's a lot to be said about both the more general question about learning from unusual organizations and then definitely about the Sicilian Mafia. Okay, so here's what I'm thinking. And in part, this may feel like speaking or preaching to the converted. And this is a simplification, but nevertheless, I cherish this opportunity to say a few words about the way I'm thinking about doing historical research on organizations that are not the usual business organizations that we're studying, and then making them work or resonate with those kinds of questions and interests or issues or discussions that are deemed as relevant in organization theory. So basically, historical analysis, this is very high level, but I'm getting to some points here, don't worry. So we know that historical analysis emphasizes and is based on rich description, of course, analysis and gathering an analysis of rich data and then rich description. And of course, most historians tend to value the accumulation of knowledge over time more than a very specific or explicit focus on theoretical contributions. Now, I'm not saying that historians don't have theoretical contributions, but I think most of us know what I'm talking about, which is that when we are writing for business history, for example, as a great journal and outlet, or if we are working on books, it's slightly different from publishing in the journals that have been highlighted in this seminar series like the one that I'm going to be talking about in a moment. Then again, organization theory. Now I'm partly making a stereotypical, maybe straw man about organization theory, whatever that is, but I think it's pretty clear, at least from the ways in which the papers that are published tend to look like in the leading journals, that the point is that the case or that thing that one is studying has to have some more general relevance in terms of having an impact on some discussion, making us think differently. And oftentimes these are also the words that we're using. It's important that we talk about the contribution explicitly, and we talk about how the things change or are challenged because of our findings. And you know, there's a big debate actually whether this preoccupation with the theoretical contribution has gone too far in journals such as AMJ that I would know best. So what's the solution? I'm not the person usually who says that, you know, there's a formula or there are success factors, but I'm for once trying to just say a couple of things that seem to be working for me. And those three are up there. And I think it's a question of, like, now I'm talking about a paper that is based on historical analysis that is submitted and hopefully then makes it in our leading organization theory or management journals. They tend to combine two narratives. The narrative that is important from a historical perspective, or the one that really, you know, is the story that people get excited about. And then the other narrative, which is the theoretical contribution narrative. So combining the two, I think, is really the key thing. And to me, that this translates to at least three things which seem to be important. One is to, you know, make sense of what this is a case of, as people oftentimes put it, in terms of, in my words, turning the uniqueness in the unusual organization into a revealing case. I think that's the way of, like, maintaining the specialty, the thing that really interests people, with the idea that, you know, there's some generalizability here. I would, of course, emphasize authenticity in any kind of work, but I think authenticity is really important method-wise, also in historical analysis. And sometimes it's a question of drawing the line in the sand or water, I suppose, when, you know, simplifying some of the methodological things that we're doing in, for instance, different types of qualitative analysis. But I think in historical analysis, there are certain kinds of key features that are important, for instance, in terms of really valuing the initial sources and so forth. And I think that the third point is probably the one that we struggle most with, which is trying to find a way to communicate the combination of the two narrative in a way that the theorizing or the theoretical contribution really comes across in the structure of the paper. And to me, this usually means that the, you know, when one finds the one way of, or the right way, or one of the right ways of finding the right headlines and structure for the empirical findings part, then one is already a long way in terms of making it in combining the two narratives and making a theoretical contribution. So that's basically what I'm trying to communicate here, knowing very well that there are different kinds of approaches in historical analysis. And of course, Juhanti and I, we have also written about this, and Dan and many others as participants have probably gone much further in this reflection. But that's the overall frame. That's the more general thing that Christian and Zevin were pointing to in terms of my presentation. There's not much more. Well, there could be much more if we start talking about these things. But I'm going to use this as a lens to then dig deep, or not that deep, at least present our paper about the Sicilian Mafia. And let's move on to that one. So this is the paper that we got to write, or I got to write with my two colleagues and friends, Giulia Capellaro and Amelia Compagni from Bocconi in Milan. And of course, it started with a general interest in this topic, and many of us are interested in the Mafia. I mean, I've always been a fan of the, you know, Mafia stories and books and and then movies and all the rest of it. Many of us share this interest in the mafia, but this project allowed us to go deeper into some aspects of what the Sicilian mafia has been and how it has developed. And of course, as it is oftentimes in our projects, it takes some time before we find the final framing, you know? And usually this happens only in the revision process, and it happened to us as well. So we took some time for us to find the right angle or this angle that eventually became strategic ambiguity. Okay, so a few points about the paper, which then relates to this bigger question. So starting points. Studying the mafia can be done in a lot of ways, but we didn't infiltrate the organization, but this is historical research. And talking about the mafia, there's actually a lot of material available. So in a way, this was not one of the most difficult archival projects, but there were some limits to this. So I have to emphasize that Julia in particular, and also Amelia, they did a great job also in some of the archives where for some reason, for instance, some of the confessions of the pentiti are the other from mafia's perspective traitors, those who have become the ones that then reveal what the mafia is all about. So there were aspects of the material which were harder to get access to, but on the whole, the problem was more that there was so much of it, and that was the difficult thing here. By the way, with mafia, I think we have two things to always, which is gets kind of emotional in a way, that we have this interest in this romantic view of the Godfather or something, and then we have the harsh reality. So there's a collection of the policemen and prosecutors and judges killed by the mafia during our study there up there. But then we focused on strategic ambiguity. To share one anecdote that I've told some people, at least Juhanti, before. So we were not worried about doing this, but we did have some conversations with people who have been studying the mafia from other angles. And one of them told us that it's not a problem to study Sicilian mafia from this perspective, and as a university professor, you are that's okay, they won't touch you. But this person also said that it went like this, that I would be much more cautious in terms of studying the Russian mafia, for instance. So we've been good, although Julia did get one phone call, which was an interesting sign of the mafia still being somewhere there, hidden, and then we didn't know where it came, but there was one call about the project clearly from the mafia's representatives. Okay, so what are we doing? I was just in a moment ago saying that, well, there has to be this way of like combining two narratives and making that into a structure which communicates the key theoretical points. And in our case, it's this. And now when I present it like this, it kind of feels like disappointment, lame, in a sense that it's like three periods of time. Well, we know that oftentimes historical analysis or qualitative analysis or any analysis doesn't really follow the periods in terms of more traditional analysis, which is chronological. But in our case, it turned out that these different periods or parts of these periods help us illustrate different types of ambiguity and struggles over ambiguity. And these are the key points and findings. There isn't much more in the paper, basically, just we're saying that, ambiguity becomes an issue, which is one of the keys for the mafia so that they can protect themselves from public scrutiny. So unlike in, much of research in organizational theory about ambiguity, where they're saying that ambiguity is basically bad, here we're saying that, well, yes, maybe it is, but ambiguity may be good for such an organization that wants to remain hidden or protect itself. And it's this play between the mafia and then the state representatives who are trying to, pin them down and prosecute, which is at the core of this study. But when we go into those nuances of the three types of struggles, opacity, equivocality, and absurdity, then we actually find some interesting things, and I'm just going to highlight a few. So there's this really long first period. And I'll start with an anecdote, which is that now, you know, retrospectively, it feels so kind of, you know, that's the way it went, kind of a story. But doing, you know, some of this research really made us realize that it was actually very ambiguous in the beginning of the 60s, where we started this. This is the picture, by the way, is from the so-called Chiaculli killing, which was an event that triggered a more general public interest in the mafia. But at that point, and this is what I was struggling to say, this organization didn't really have a very good name even. So it was really hard to get into it because actually the term mafia comes from a novel about gangs in Napoli, whereas actually Sicilian mafia is nothing like that. It's not in Napoli, it's not gangs, but men of honor. So it couldn't be more wrong than it was. But anyway, this thing was imported and took a long time before people also within the mafia started using this term. But that was one of the aspects of opacity in the sense that mafia was protecting what it was. And as we know, there's even this code of science, silence, omerta, which still prevails in the sense that there are many things that you are not supposed to reveal. Or if you do, you may disappear. And by the way, one of the other anecdotes of this project was that we learned a great deal about the methods of making people disappear. So if you need that kind of expertise, I know how to do this, at least in principle or in theory, you know, bathtubs or concrete. So concrete meaning construction, and lots of people put into, basements like Juhantis, I don't know. So, you know, sorry about the sidelines. I'm making really bad remarks and bad jokes here along the way. But so the mafia is trying to protect itself.
You know, we are all glad we are not your reviewers for any of the paper, we hope.
Yeah, you know, we would come hard at you after this. So what are the state representatives doing? Well, they are actually struggling. And in a way, I'm a little bit disappointed by the way the paper turned out, because at one point we had this idea that it's more about the state representatives who are trying to develop this framework as to how to make sense of things. Now it's a kind of a dynamic between the two groups, which prioritizes the mafia. But actually, in a way, that's even more interesting, because they really struggle for a long time to develop a name and label or a category for this kind of criminal activity, and then to be able to specify it such and even legitimate that, so that that would become a way of getting at those criminals, meaning a law. And this eventually happened. So that's an interesting story, where this part of this ambiguity in terms of opacity or unclarity becomes something more concrete finally. And then we get to the second period. And this is an interesting one. And actually lots of YouTube videos about this. So I recommend watching the so-called Moxi trials, which means that lots of mafiosi were for the first time really being held accountable, and lots of stories and lots of interesting things happening. We are pointing to a few strategies of trying to maintain ambiguity, which were played out differently by those who were the ones confessing, meaning the pentiti, and those who were just playing it so that they tried to just confuse all people. But this also shown that the mafia itself was changing in a way, that there were different interpretations of what being men of honor, for instance, meant. And at the same time, those who were the state representatives, and this is a little bit of a simplification, they were trying to prioritize this one interpretation, which basically was that, hey, it's a question of this kind of a criminal organization. And if you are a member of that, then you are part of the mafia, you're a mafiosi, we have the law, you can be convicted. Okay. There's a really cool movie also in Netflix, which is called Our Godfather, about Tommaso Buscetta, who was one of the pentiti. It's a really nice documentary, so I recommend watching that. By the way, also fiction came into play. A lot of interesting discussions around the nature of the mafia, which made references to the book, Mario Puzo's book, Godfather, and the films. So basically, people were playing with ambiguity. Well, I'll stop there. And because I want to move to the third period. So third period, what happens? This is the period, in a way, we're still living. And this is an interesting period, because what happens is that the state representatives get some of the mafiosi convicted. And there's a clearer and clearer understanding that, okay, this is what the mafia does, and that's bad, and we can get at those. At the same time, mafia, of course, also changes and responds and tries to hide. But the state representatives are ambitious. They also want to go further into the networks. You could call it the gray area, in a way, of getting at those corrupt politicians or business people or others who are, if not playing exactly the same roles as those who would be soldiers or captains or having other positions within the core structure of a mafia's war or military type of organization, that they would also be held accountable. But of course, this wasn't easy, and actually, this is simplification, but our interpretation is that it hasn't really succeeded. This is in part because, probably for a good reason, they were getting at people like Giulio Andreotti, who was up there, the longest serving prime minister in Italy, who clearly, you know, now we know, was in many ways, implicated in terms of collaborating with the mafia. But eventually, what happened, that he got sick and died, and it didn't come into any conclusion. But it seemed like it was becoming more and more of an absurd story, in a way that that those who were criticizing the ways in which the judges and the prosecutors, first of all, were approaching mafia were just going too far in terms of finding mafiosi everywhere. So this became, in a way, also a question of categories and labels and whether they would make sense. But then those who were prosecuted is or other members of the mafia, they were really playing this game of stereotyping and also making fun at times, making some of the claims and projects of the prosecutors ridiculous. And that's about it. There's a lot to be said. Suggestive pictures there as well, in terms of, for instance, Silvio Berlusconi. There's a lot of questions around his activities as well, but so far he hasn't really been pinned down. This is the final, next to the final slide I'm just going to show, but this is the final part of the empirical analysis, which is our model. So this is the more generalizable part. So all these, you know, nuances and anecdotes and aspects of the three types of struggles, we try to put them together in a model that explains how it can be in terms of organizations that really try to, you know, hide themselves and at least avoid public scrutiny, how they may be playing the game and how this relates to ambiguity. And I just want to say that, of course, the actual real story is much more complicated and nuanced than the one that we are telling. So we want to here highlight some of the strategies that the mafia was using, as well as those of the state representatives. And this also culminates in this paralysis, as we call it, in a way of not being able to deal with this absurdity that emerges from some of the claims and efforts to get at the mafia. And to be honest, when we finished this off, which was about a year ago, I was feeling unsure about this. And I was kind of thinking that maybe we go too far in pointing that there's some kind of a paralysis. And that I was thinking that maybe the mafia actually is, if not beaten, at least, you know, it's much, much less involved than what was the case in previous years. But I was proved wrong, as is often the case. And I think one of the interesting signs was that when the COVID-19 pandemic really hit Italy and also Sicily, actually what happened was that then again, the men of honor and their organizations and families in Sicily actually became much more visible, and they were trying to help the poor and others who were hit by the direct or indirect implications of the pandemic. So there's yet another period of time where this time mafia is strategically presenting parts of it, because that's creating goodwill, and that's a part of it which is, you know, trying to protect their own. Right. The final thing I want to say is going back to the issue of what's then the theoretical contribution. So how do these two narratives come together? The empirical story that I've told you, you know, which includes all these quite interesting anecdotes and twists and turns, and there's so many of those, by the way, that we had a real problem in selecting the ones we include in the paper. But how does this relate to the theoretical story? Well, we start and end with strategic ambiguity. So the point is that we think that our analysis precisely adds to our understanding of ambiguity in organizations. But this is the other side that hasn't been so far giving adequate attention to, which is maintaining strategic ambiguity to be able to protect oneself from public scrutiny. And another interesting aspect of this is that we also get close to the issues of silence and silencing, which are, you know, almost like natural themes in the mafia context, but nevertheless also interesting issues in the broader context of organization theory. And of course, we think that this specifically helps to, add to the stream of research that we have about these kinds of unusual organizations, that is clandestine organizations. And there are some things that are particularly interesting, especially the question of how ambiguity and secrecy come together. And I'll stop here. So thanks for listening. And I'm looking forward to questions or comments or whatever you have on top of your minds.
Thank you, Eero. That was great. So I would, although Christian and Jerem say that you can raise your hand, so but I would propose that if and when you have comments, please write onto the chat, and I will pick up comments from there first in that order when they appear, and then I try to cluster comments if they are like too many. So we have plenty of time, 25 minutes for the discussion. So who wants to start? And Eero, do you want to share your screen or do you want to stop sharing?
I think that's an implicit suggestion not to share, right? Yeah. Okay.
Yes, thank you. Okay, Emily, please. You have the first one.
Hi, thank you. I read the article last week, and I thought it was really interesting. So I appreciate the summary of what you've given. I found the last period particular interesting. Was it period of absurdity? Was that the term that was used? And I wonder. I mean, because it seems quite a diversion from how they behaved in the previous two periods. And I wonder, was that a strategy that was learned? If you can gauge if that is a strategy that was learned from anywhere, because it seems like a pretty smart tactic, really. And I just wonder if that's, I mean, you might not be able to tell. I know the types of documents you were working with. But I just wonder if you had any thoughts on any of the periods, really, if this was something that was collectively learned from an outside source or, you know, internally determined.
Thanks, Emily. That's a great question. One of the learning points for us was during this process was that indeed there's no one type of strategic ambiguity. So that drove us to highlight these different types in different periods. But it turned out to be relatively easy in a way that there were like at least times in these periods that were really characterized by these particular aspects of ambiguity. So in this case, indeed, absurdity. And we struggle a little bit with this term. Now, I think this strategy, I'm thinking the learning was more of the kind that it was really triggered by what the state representatives were doing. So it's too much to say that it's like a dialectic of things, or at least that's not our theoretical frame, but it's definitely a struggle where you have different sides. So whatever the state representatives try to do then triggers the response from the mafia. And then the mafia, I don't think that all of these strategies are like really things that they strategize. I don't think that they have grand strategies as to how to react to the state representatives' projects or activities or accusations or whatever they're doing. But they're more like almost like instinctive reactions. And then when some things seem to be working, then they push that on. And interestingly, this is not in the paper, really. Maybe it should be. I think this, especially this question of absurdity, was something where also the general audience or the media was implicated. So it wasn't the mafia themselves, but it was also that there was this unholy alliance in a way. I'm sure that the media doesn't see it this way, which went then on in terms of delegitimizing many of the efforts of the state representatives and pointing to the weaknesses and indeed absurdities in the accusations of, like, in particular, how can we really see Giulio Andreotti as a mafioso? And there it didn't go well because it was too big of a stretch from this construction of a category of a mafioso that they had pinned down earlier through the gray zone into something light gray in terms of someone who is definitely culpable of many bad things, but just is not something that the mafiosis that they were prosecuting and dealing with in the previous period were like. So I think there's learning. I think the learning also relates to this time. So we're getting close to the present date where indeed the media and when it also the social media, although we didn't really focus on that, has played a big role. So it's different from the previous ones.
That's great. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Eero. So I will next pick up Christina's comment, which is related, and it's about the temporal bracketing. So how did you choose? Or Christina, do you want to elaborate your comment?
Yeah, no, I would love to ask a question about that if I'm allowed. Thank you, Eero, for sharing this. And I like how you introduced it as kind of saying history and organization studies are on this journey together and they're getting closer maybe to each other. I sure learned a lot about organizational theory in the past couple of years. And when you introduce this periodization or temporal bracketing, that feels very familiar to me as a historian. I think that, and it drives your theorization. So that's definitely something that a historian would do just the same way. The thing I was missing from a history perspective is we oftentimes then look at, like, is there competing periodizations that maybe the literature has already introduced and that can help us clarify why this periodization over another? And how do you think through the transition periods from one period to another? That would be the historical approach to this. And I know you're not writing for a historical audience, but I feel like since we're going towards dual integrity, as Mary would say, maybe we can kind of inspire each other a little bit in that way.
That's a great question. And it really fits with the overall idea. I think about this seminar that we're talking about higher level methodological issues. And I have this nagging feeling that we could have done a better job with this periodization. I'm one of those who actually doesn't immediately trust that a chronological story is the best way of telling the theoretical story. So usually I think in my papers that's not the case, but here it just went so well easily. I mean, maybe just too easy that there were things like the Maxi trials definitely took place in a particular, time and space. So it was easy to see that as part of the period. And the first period was a relatively easy point, this Ciaculli killing event, that triggered the broader public discussion about the mafia in Italy, really for the first time. So these were like easy, I don't know, signposts or things that drove us to this. But I would defend theoretically this from the point of view that the real issue is that there are three types of ambiguity. Now, I think that we could find also the other types of ambiguity in all periods, although perhaps absurdity not so much in the first or second period. And in a way of then putting things together, I was at one point thinking that we should say more about like how also, you know, the omerta, you know, this culture and code of silence also played a role in the third period. So there are things that we're missing with this simplified structure.
Yes, thank you. So then we have Sandeep, you had your hand raised.
Hi, thank you for a wonderful presentation, Iro. I'm going to, I guess, ask a little bit of a different question, not exactly related to the paper, but a more general historical method related question. And this may be a reflection of my lack of training in the history department. But you started off by saying that, you know, getting sources was not the problem. So a challenge you faced was privileging some information over the other. And a challenge we often have, especially when you're writing in management journals, is finding that balance for theory versus the evidence, anecdotal evidence. I was just curious if you had any thought, what your approach to that was, because, you know, on one hand, you can say, I'm going to do an in-depth case study and really get into the details of an outlier case, maybe. And on the other hand, you can think of, I'm going to do many multiple caselets or, you know, and a variety of strategies in between. So I was just, so my question, I guess, in one line would be, do you have any, I mean, your thoughts on how you privilege some information from the context over others when you're building your argument? Is there a process that you think go through? Do you have some tips as a reviewer and as an editor that you've seen people do it well? Thank you.
A wonderful question, an important one. And of course, I don't have a good answer to this. To me, it is a kind of like this term abductive reasoning, that it goes back and forth, or we go back and forth, this dynamics of like discovery in the empirical material and increasing theoretical sophistication and theoretical discovery. And I think it happened here, at least. We had it pretty clear from the start that we are interested in this story. And initially it was more about how to, you know, remain hidden, and then about like how can the state representatives develop the frameworks and categories so that they can get into these criminals, which then was transformed to this ambiguity story at the end. So there's this theoretical journey as well that we took whilst gathering, or at least reprocessing the data. I think, and it's really thanks to Julia and Amelia, we are on a pretty solid basis in the sense that we made some selections such that we really went to the original data more than, for instance, relying on the many, many books and articles that there are about the mafia. So that could have been another way of looking at it, like already relying on what others have found. But I think we did the right choice in sort of trying to get to the bottom of things. Then it was a difficult one with media as a source, because in a way that is an important part, but we also tried to not to place too much emphasis on that, so that we would really get into this dynamic of what the state representatives are trying to do when they're trying to make sense of the mafia, what it is in the first place, and then trying to develop the framework that helps them to get through this, initially opacity and then equivocality. And so that's the story. And I know that I am not really answering your question too well. It sounds like more like a process of discovery or magic than a really good, good answer. But it's most often the case, I think.
Right, and it's good to know how the hot dog is made sometimes. Yes. So thank you so much for elaborating on it.
Yes. So I would like to destroy my own ordering because Dundraff actually has some, Dan, your comment is very close to this previous one. So you do want to elaborate your question about the relationship between theory and historical research and analysis in this project, and perhaps more generally as well.
Okay, so my question was whether the rhetorical strategy being suggested here was to, first of all, to recognize the theme from the managerial academia literature in a striking or otherwise memorable example, and then using that example to introduce new distinctions or ideas, for example, about possible mechanisms, etc. Ideas in the literature are very often about the patterns of outcomes, but not really very good about isolating mechanism. I don't want to get bogged down in the detail of what would constitute a mechanism, but we could take that up if you wanted. So a different way of putting this question is to ask, what was in this project the relationship between theory on the one hand, as it exists in the management academia discourse, and historical research and analysis?
That's a really good question. And I actually find the first framing easier to respond in a way that I think that was our journey that we... Or like you put it, I think you are steps ahead here. Our rhetorical strategy in the final document is to tell the story, our story, such that ambiguity plays a big role in organizations and organization theory. But there are things that have been missed or things that haven't been really understood. And one of those is this, that, you know, there's also this question of using ambiguity for protection of public scrutiny. And in that sense, that became the starting point in our rhetorical construction of the argument. And then I think the analysis mostly then elaborates on those. Maybe there are patterns. I would hope that there are also mechanisms, at least there are types of ambiguity. And then there's this underlying dynamic of strategies and actions between the two sides that provides the mechanism for the processual development that we can see. So I would see this way, and I think it was less of a study or a paper which would start from like a theoretical issue that already exists that we would challenge, for instance. This, I think, was more that this side of ambiguity, use of it for basically positively for protection from the mafia side or similar clients and organization side, that was the thing that perhaps made this more empirical than could have otherwise.
If I could add a very brief comment, it's been a commonplace of the philosophy of science literature since I think the early 1960s that most scientific research doesn't go on in the form in which the results are written up. I guess the counterpart to that in what you were describing in the beginning of your talk is that the sort of research that we do may need to be formulated in particular ways to be appealing to management journal referees and editors. There was a period in which business historians seemed to think that meant framing their material in terms of hypotheses and some counterpart to statistical hypothesis testing. I see your paper as strongly suggesting that that's much too concrete, and that there are rhetorical strategies which will grab the attention of these audiences without pretending to be hypothesis tests. Anyway, that's what I was.
I would agree. And I hope hope that the papers that we're doing, I have nothing against hypothesis per se, but hopefully we can also get into these more nuanced relationships that sometimes also allow for multiple interpretations that I think would be important from the history's point of view.
Yes, thank you, Ran, and thank you, Eero. So the next comment is by Juha Laurila. So Juha, your comment was, I think, especially like what concerns or what is historical and what is not historical research. So,
I paid attention to the fact that you bring the study until 2018, so close to the present. And in a way, when you have been writing the paper, for us collecting the data and so forth, in a way, you've been very close to the present. And then I noticed that you mentioned that you mostly, as I understood it, you mostly rely on your own data instead of those studies, for example, on mafia conducted by others. So, but at least I think those historical studies which rely also on the works of others, which in a way pile up those very close periods, studies concerning them may have not yet appeared. So any important information concerning the period that you're focusing on, at least the latest of them, in a way, you might learn many new things about this period, and in a way you don't take that into account. So, but that need not be a problem for your study, but in a way for many historical studies, it might be a problem. And because I'm not an expert in historical studies, that's why I'm asking this.
Well, thanks for the question. I think you are an expert in these fantastic historical longitudinal studies. So I think many of us are in the same boat here. I think there are two aspects that I want to comment upon. One is that, it may be that this would be a much better paper if we had relied more on what we know from other studies. But there's a lot of stuff on mafia, and it's very... of course, it's a fragmented literature because there are scientists from different disciplines doing that. But not many came close to our interests. So that's why it felt like let's go to the original one, original sources to the extent possible. We can tell the story as it was rather than saying that, this person's book, even if it's a landmark in this, studies of criminology about mafia, that that was the excuse for dismissing some of that. But you're right that this then has this unfortunate effect that by reading our paper, people cannot see the accumulation of knowledge because we are very restrictive in terms of references to others' work. About the fact that we extend this to almost today, I think it's true that so we don't know from other studies what's going on close to today. Maybe we could have just ended a few years earlier, but we felt tempted to extend it so that in a way we would trigger this reflection among the readers that it's still going on. It's not historical in the sense that this happened in the 1960s, which could have been a really cool study, I think. In hindsight, just focusing on that period, but we wanted to perhaps foolishly go as far as we can in terms of saying that, it's still going on. And I wanted to really share that perhaps unclear anecdote with you about the mafia, what it's doing like 2020 in terms of, again, playing it differently.
Thank you.
Thank you. And then we have a comment by Eero Aalto. So I read Eero, your comment perhaps differently than you mean, but perhaps you want to elaborate, and then perhaps we can continue with the discussion after your comment.
Yeah, Yes, I can be briefly. Thank you, Eero, for the nice presentation and really interesting paper. And you mentioned sort of the current situation in Italy and the COVID and how the men of honor become more visible in Sicily again. So that made me think of sort of the historical context and the embeddedness of mafia, and more precisely the economic conditions. So I remember this paper, I put a link there, that the origins of Sicilian mafia is in lemon trade, or and sort of the economic conditions which were occurring at that time. And also if we take the American mafia, the Godfather, which you had a picture about, that was also much about business. They were investing a lot and very influential in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So I was just, maybe this is a too broad question, but I was thinking like the economic conditions of mafia operating and organizing itself. So did you see any that kind of influence in your study, and what could you say about that?
Well, I'm thankful for the link and study that actually I'm ashamed to say that I don't know. I just opened it here. Yeah, sure. I think economics or economic conditions have played a really big role, as have political conditions. So if we go back to the beginnings of the mafia, there are different interpretations of this, not least because of the difficulty in finding the right terms. Men of honor emerged around the time, or a little bit before the time Italy was formed, in the mid-19th century. Some people trace the origins far further back in history, but at least those were important time points when there were wars and power struggles, which kind of left, this is one, not an economic, but political science explanation of mafia's birth, that there was then a void or that the mafia was, or men of honor were to fill, because Sicily was left on its own, so to speak. And that was the beginning of this, in some people's views, in terms of creating these family type of structures and networks that were then, I think, doing a lot of things at the same time, obviously in society, and sort of being a substitute of the absence of state power at this one point. But then the story of the mafia is definitely, like you say, it's a question of economic conditions and about business as well, like this uneasy relationship of being a criminal organization and doing business that may in part be legitimate. And there are so many stories about this that probably everyone knows, in terms of like the different, by the way, these are different types of mafia. You know, Sicilian mafia is different from the mafia in Naples, for instance. So we have to make a distinction, at least for our study, that makes a difference. But if you guys have been following what's been going on in Napoli, for instance, the local mafia has been so much involved in the, you know, in all these scandals about, you know, waste handling, basically turning that into something which is not good. Basically, this is a little bit of a sideline. I'm fully with you in terms of economic conditions. One anecdote to add, and maybe we're running out of time, is that it has also played a role in these different transitions. And for instance, for a long time, prostitution and drugs were absolutely forbidden by the Sicilian mafia. But then the world changed, and the generation of mafiosi changed, and they became the core thing. This is actually quite nicely depicted in the US case. If you've seen the movie Godfather, the you know, number one, there's this interesting turning point where these things are, well, basically the drugs are introduced, and Don Corleone says no, but you can see that the next generation, Sonny Corleone, would have been perhaps willing to go along that, which had a big impact on the wars between the families, and that's a big part of that film in terms of the story to be told.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. So I recognize that, Andrew, I think your comment was already responded concerning temporal bracketing question. So Jerim and Christian, so first of all, I want to like to thank Eero once more, so Eero Vaarana and Eero Aalto, for the comment